Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. The ongoing fires in the West have burned more than 4 million acres, devastating hundreds of communities and forcing tens of thousands of people to flee. At least 33 people have been killed and dozens are missing. Oregon Governor Kate Brown says the state is preparing for a mass fatality event. Joining us with an update on the Oregon fires is Jason Wilson, an independent journalist. Jason is covering the deadly fires in Oregon for The Guardian, and he joins us from Portland. Hi, Jason. Welcome back to the show.
Lovely to talk to you again so soon, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you back, Jason. The stories coming out of Oregon are just devastating. Five towns have been completely destroyed. The fires have reached from the southern border to the coast all the way up to Portland. There are about, 10 big fires now happening across the state? Is that right?
Yes, although, you know, the numbers change because the fires keep merging. You know, a new one start. It's a terrible, terrible fire season. You know, it's happening to a large extent in a part of the state where we wouldn't expect necessarily fires on this scale. And it's happening much earlier than the normal fire season, which we would expect to begin further into fall.
Senator Jeff Merkley on the ABC program this week yesterday said, quote, "I drove 600 miles up and down the state and I never escaped the smoke. We have thousands of people who've lost their homes. I could have never envisioned this." But, I mean, just tell us what people are talking about, because as you said, so much of this is just unprecedented in Oregon.
Well, people are talking about different things. I mean, I think that Senator Merkley is an example of someone who, you know, is wanting to connect this to the impacts of climate change. Now, you know, climate scientists are very careful people, as you may know if you've ever talked to any of them. You know, they don't make bold claims. They don't say that the causal relationship is direct. What they tend to say is that, yes, wildfires are a regular occurrence in the West, but, you know, the fire season is longer. The conditions are worse, and what that means is that we get more severe fires over a greater proportion of the year. And, you know, now those fires are threatening the West's major cities, such as Portland. We've got, you know, gigantic forest fires, you know, just 30 miles from the city.
Right. We had Michael Mann on last week, a climate scientist, who said that that the climate crisis exacerbates these fires. And you can find that at yourcallradio.org. Let's just talk about the casualties. At least 33 people have been killed along the West. Dozens are missing. And this is getting a lot of attention, the fact that Oregon's Governor Kate Brown says the state is preparing for a mass fatality event. What else can you tell us about that?
Well, I think Governor Brown, said that, late last week when, you know, the complete impact of these wildfires simply wasn't known. A lot of these fires are happening in, initially at least, the fires were most affecting, you know, mountain towns and places that are difficult to access in conditions of natural disaster. At that time, we knew that five towns had been completely destroyed. One east of Salem, the state capital. Two a little further southeast of Eugene, which is where the University of Oregon is, and then a couple between Ashland and Medford in the state's far south. And at that point, we just didn't know. We knew that, you know, many, many structures had been destroyed. We knew that the fires had spread very quickly and people had been given very little warning in some cases. The mayor of Detroit told OPB, Oregon Public Broadcasting, has decided that you know, they were alerted by banging on the door, you know, in the middle of the night. There was very little warning. I think that, some of the missing people now have been accounted for. They just turned up either at a friend's house or some rescue center. But there are still a lot of people missing. And, I think that sensibly, the governor was preparing the state for the worst, really. It may not be as bad as we thought it was then, but it's still devastating. You know, people have lost their homes. Entire towns have been destroyed that may never be rebuilt, and certainly will never be the same. And, you know, we've had kind of massive evacuations within the limits of the Portland metro area. We've seen towns like Malala and Sandy evacuated, you know, which are in Clackamas County, which is, you know, part of the Portland metro area. And then we had Oregon City, which is even closer in, subject to level two evacuation, and a lot of people left Oregon City at that point. So I talked to evacuees from Oregon City and Malala who were, you know, camped behind an Elks Lodge in the southeastern suburbs of Portland. And all of them, as well as the firefighters I've talked to, were uniform in saying, you know, that they'd never seen anything like this in all of their time in Oregon. And some of those folks have been living here for a really long time. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is absolutely an inflection point for the state of Oregon and the whole West. You know, we had a very severe fire season in 2018 as well, but now we're seeing, you know, on a regular basis in fire season, we're seeing the major cities, you know, including global cities like San Francisco, really feeling the effects of these fires. You know, it's not just a rural problem anymore. It's not a problem for mountain towns. It's affecting the whole West Coast of the United States.
Right. Today we're speaking with Jason Wilson, an independent journalist covering the deadly fires in Oregon for The Guardian. He'll be with us for about 10 more minutes. So if you have any questions for Jason, if you have friends and family in Oregon, if you're in Oregon and you have a story to share, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Jason, what are the cause of some of these larger fires? Do we know at this point?
You know, I think that a lot of this is subject to investigation, and, you know, at times it's difficult to ascertain the cause of a large fire that starts in a remote area. We know that, you know, fires can be caused by lightning, fires can be caused by humans, you know, frequently accidentally, but also, you know, arson is a thing that exists. So there have been a few arrests for arson, but not directly, only one of which has been directly kind of related to one of the larger fires. There has unfortunately been a lot of disinformation and misinformation, which has really been complicating, you know, the evacuation and rescue efforts in rural Oregon. Unfortunately, on social media, there have been, I had a story on The Guardian about this come out this morning. You know, there have been a lot of people, including, unfortunately, elected officials, spreading rumors on social media that, you know, all of this was as a result of a kind of coordinated attack by extremists. You know, usually people are claiming it's Antifa who are lighting fires deliberately for some reason. And, you know, that has led to armed patrols, roadblocks, and kind of vigilante action in some parts of rural Oregon. So, in my story this morning, you know, I kind of, quite prominent in that story is an incident where Southeast of Decatur in Clackamas County, a photojournalist was held up by men at gunpoint and was not allowed to leave. You know, he had a guy blocking two lanes of the road. And, you know, they were insisting that he was a looter, even though he repeatedly identified himself as a journalist, you know, and while he has a loaded gun pointed at him. So, you know, unfortunately, but principally Facebook, but social media is really complicating this situation, and people are not, you know, getting quality information a lot of the time, and, you know, they're acting on rumors that don't really have any basis in reality.
I mean, this is the last thing that officials need right now. You report that officials in Oregon have turned to Facebook to knock down these narratives. The FBI says it's investigating claims and found them to be untrue. So this is actually could be potentially dangerous if you have these so-called vigilantes out. The officials have to deal with letting people know what's going on, ensure that they have the best information as possible, but then they have to deal with this misinformation online at the same time.
Yeah, that's correct, and it's a potentially deadly situation. There have been two incidents involving four journalists now, where journalists have had guns trained on them in Oregon, in Clackamas County, in fact. And I mean, I don't know how often you use Facebook, Rose, or whether you're involved in any, you know, kind of private groups associated with, particular neighborhoods or localities. But, you know, if you look inside the ones associated with rural Oregon at the moment, a lot of them are just awash in this misinformation that, often seems impervious to those corrections by officials that you mentioned. It's a very, very difficult problem. And as an Australian, I know that in the wildfire crisis that happened in Australia in January, you know, pretty much the same thing happened. There was a flood of disinformation suggesting that the fires were either deliberately lit or the result of, environmentally attuned land management, whereas, simple and sensible explanation is just that the west coast of the United States and the east coast of Australia are drying out because of the effects of climate change.
And this is ongoing. I mean, you write that Facebook did not respond to a request for comment about disinformation and really dangerous information on their platform. You also write about Lars Larson, a right-wing talk radio show host based in Portland, who says, like a lot of you, I suspect all of these fires make me suspicious. You also reached out to Larson's producer asking for evidence of Antifa involvement in the fires, and they went unanswered. I mean, Jason, this is dangerous. I mean, I think we just really need to do a show about how are we going to deal with this dangerous misinformation that's being spread that people act upon?
I really don't know, Rose, and it's as journalists, I think a lot of us are people who, are able to approach, terrible situations and often be less sensitive to them than other people might be, and that enables us to do our job. And so, I can cover a fire or I can cover, an extremist group and not feel feelings of hopelessness, but when I see on social media, people just accepting this information uncritically. And then not only that, but seeing them receive corrections from the FBI or from law enforcement saying this isn't true and being completely skeptical about them and then wrapping that in another conspiracy theory, that's when I feel hopelessness. That makes me feel like, how are we going to solve all of these other terrible problems we have if we cannot even agree on, facts and reality? Yeah, I don't know what we're going to do about it. I mean, the fact that neither a social media company nor a broadcaster felt obliged to answer a reporter's question about this also makes me feel like, that these organizations don't feel like they're accountable to anyone. It's disturbing.
Well, we're going to definitely do a show about this. We have two questions from listeners, Jason. Can you give us an update on what's happening in Medford, Oregon?
I think in Medford, Oregon, at this stage, the worst of the emergency there has passed. But unfortunately, we have a lot of people down there who don't have homes. So the two towns that were destroyed were basically kind of on the outskirts of Medford, on the road between Ashland and Medford. So that's where most of the population is in that part of southern Oregon. And, hundreds of structures there have been destroyed. So we have a long-term problem. And I know that in Australia there are still people who have not been rehomed after those fires in January. This... unfortunately, sometimes in the media, you know, when the dramatic moment has passed, too often we don't kind of follow up. But I can tell you that this is going to be a long-term problem. And I think in that part of Southern Oregon, they're going to be dealing with the impacts of this wildfire for a very long time to come.
Yeah, and according to USA Today, Medford is one of Oregon's most populous cities with about 83,000 people, and many of the destroyed homes were mobile homes or trailers housing some of the area's poorest residents, which is just, I mean, it's all so devastating. And another caller, Jason, wanted you to comment on how this might affect voting in Oregon.
Oh, it's so difficult to say. I mean, we've got a kind of layered disaster here in Oregon at the moment. You know, like everyone, the citizens of Oregon are dealing with the coronavirus pandemic. There have been a series of extremely, increasingly contentious protests downtown, where, you know, Black Lives Matter protesters have come into conflict with Portland police and then you know, the federal police that Trump administration sent in over the objections of the governor and the mayor. And then, you know, more recently, the far-right groups have been going downtown and engaging in sort of violent confrontations with those protesters. And that one of those incidents resulted in one of the far-right protesters being shot dead just a couple of weeks ago. And then his alleged shooter was also shot dead by U.S. Marshals in Washington State, north of Portland. Now we've got a wildfire disaster. You know, I mean, it's anyone's guess. The good thing about Oregon is that we have a long-established system of mail-in voting that works very well. So hopefully that system will be resilient enough to ensure that, you know, the minimum number of people are disenfranchised in November.
Well, Jason, please stay safe. Thank you for your reporting, and thank you for joining us again.
Thanks for having me on, Liza. I always enjoy it.
Thank you. We'll definitely have you back soon. Jason is an independent journalist who is covering the deadly fires in Oregon for The Guardian. He's been joining us from Portland, and you can read his latest stories, including one about the dangerous spread of social media about these fires. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Well, now we are going to talk about the health effects of the climate crisis, which has led to more frequent and intense heat waves, explosive fires, floods, and pollution. The air quality in several Western cities is among the worst in the world. California has been under an air quality health advisory, basically a spare the air day, for the past 29 days. People in several Oregon cities are being told to stay in their homes and not to vacuum inside their homes because that can kick up smoke particles and worsen air quality. Now we are joined by two guests. Dr. Mona Sarfati is director of the program on climate and health at George Mason University's Center for Climate Change Communication. Dr. Sarfati has been a family medicine professor and physician for over 30 years. She says it is essential to prepare future doctors to face the challenges presented by climate change so they can provide proper care. Hi, Dr. Sarfati. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. I'm very pleased to be here.
Thank you. Christina Dahl is a senior climate scientist for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Hi, Christina. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Dr. Sarfati, I want to start with you. We just got off the phone with Jason Wilson in Oregon talking about the horrific, devastating fires there. The smoke is just absolutely horrific along the West Coast. We are in this now. This is not something that we're talking about in the future. I guess overall, basic question, I mean, what concerns you the most right now about how this is affecting public health?
Well, we know that climate change is impacting the health of people all over the country right now, and probably worse in the western United States, California and Oregon, as you're just covering right now and over the course of this month and last month and perhaps the next month. But that concerns me greatly. I have a son and daughter-in-law who just moved from San Francisco further down the peninsula. I have two young children, ages 2 and 6 months. And, of course, you know, the air quality has just been terrible. Not only is air quality immediately dangerous for people who may have any kind of an underlying health condition, a lung condition or a heart condition, or a tendency to stroke, based on, you know, on hardening of the arteries. So not only that, but we know that COVID-19, is causing more fatalities in places where the air quality is worse. So it also puts people at risk of a more severe version of COVID-19 infections. So there's lots of very serious, concerning immediate health risks that are based on these widespread fires. But we also have across the country this year extreme heat, and over the last 10 years, extreme heat has been the most common cause of fatalities related to climate change. And then, of course, we have the strength in storms, which are coming quickly this year, and which we've heard about in prior years, with many billion-dollar storm events occurring over the last 10 years, and with the outlook that they will continue and cause a lot of destruction and disruption of people's lives, with the mental health implications of that, which are actually rather extreme. And then beyond that, of course, we've got the mosquitoes and ticks. So there's lots of very serious health consequences. And if we don't respond quickly to climate change, we're going to see a lot more of all of that. You know, the irony is that we know what we need to do. We need to move very, very rapidly to clean energy for our source of electricity, and also in transportation. And we need to make changes toward, regenerative agriculture as much as possible as well. So we know, and energy efficiency, of course, along with the changes in electricity. So we know exactly what we need to do. We just need to do it. And the sooner that we do it, we will see a lot of very rapid health benefits. These are not benefits that we're going to have to wait 10 years for. You know, we are going to see some very rapid health benefits. Some of the changes are the climate change problem is baked in to our experience, and the adverse effects are going to continue. But there are many that will improve very quickly if we do these things that we need to do.
Well, I just want to let listeners know that if you need any mental health or emotional support, we do have a resource page on our website at kalw.org. If you scroll down on the right side, you will see a box for that. And there are a number of resources offering everything from text lines to 24-hour peer-run lines, lines for parents, a lot of resources there, kalw.org. Christina, what would you add? What concerns you the most at this moment?
The thing that I think is really important to note, and that is of real concern to me, is that these extreme climate events, as well as the COVID-19 pandemic, disproportionately affect people of color. And that has to do with the legacy of centuries of systemic racism and racist policies in our country. So the very same groups that we see being vulnerable to these climate events are vulnerable to COVID-19, and the underlying reasons are the same. You know, if you take, for example, communities in southern Louisiana who are recently affected by Hurricane Laura, you know, these are not wealthy communities, and these are communities that have been living in the shadow of the petrochemical industry for decades. And so there are, you know, higher rates of cancer, higher rates of other diseases, asthma, that come along with that long-term exposure to air pollution. And then when you add a hurricane on top of that and potentially take away people's safe housing and kind of rip apart the community, those events have a disproportionate impact. The same could be said for communities here in California. For example, in the Central Valley of California, where 40% of the nation's food is grown, we have undocumented laborers who are disproportionately exposed to the poor air quality that happens in the Central Valley kind of chronically, but then doubly exposed when a large wildfire brings a lot of smoke into the region and they can't afford to not work outdoors. So, you know, it's these very vulnerable groups that we see exposed to the effects of racism that have been building and building for centuries, as well as to climate change. So those would be the things that I feel most concerned about.
Yeah, the United Farm Workers actually has been tweeting photos of people working in the fields. And I mean, obviously the air quality is absolutely horrific. It's, you know, 150 or more. We're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking about the health effects of the climate crisis with Christina Dahl, Senior Climate Scientist for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Dr. Mona Sarfati, Director of the Program on Climate and Health at George Mason University's Center for Climate Change Communication. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about the health effects of the climate crisis. And if you have any questions for our guests about how this is affecting public health, and if you have a story to share, how have you been doing over the last month? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're joined by Christina Dahl, Senior Climate Scientist for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Dr. Mona Sarfati is Director of the Program on Climate and Health at George Mason University's Center for Climate Change Communication. Dr. Sarfati, can we spend a little more time talking about vulnerable populations? Christina was talking about farm workers, and I wonder what your thoughts are about the unhoused populations. I mean, here in California, tens of thousands of people are sleeping on the streets, which means they are inhaling this horrific air 24/7. And I've seen a lot of people on the streets without masks, especially without the proper mask.
Yeah, that is of tremendous concern. I was mentioned before that my son and his wife and their two young children were in San Francisco, and on Saturday they moved further down the peninsula. They live in a nice place, and they had three air purifiers going inside their place. And when they moved down to the new place that they're renting, we had a long discussion about the heating and ventilation system, the HVAC system, and what they could do to improve the quality of the air. If you're outside living in a tent, or on the streets, or out in a field for that matter, for a good part of the day, you're directly exposed and really have nothing to protect you from those high particulate levels, which are extremely dangerous. And I would mention that even within those populations, the homeless populations and those working outside or, living in tents, that there are groups that are especially sensitive, and that includes children. Children breathe more per minute than adults do. And so they're taking more of those, of that smoke with all the little particles in it, into their lungs. People who have underlying lung conditions like chronic lung disease or who have any kind of a heart condition will also be at greater risk. It turns out that women who are pregnant are at greater risk, and that's because the rate of premature delivery is greater for women who are exposed to more air pollution or more heat during their pregnancy, and so pregnant women are at greater risk as well. And then, of course, if it's hot in addition, you have a heat wave. Elderly people are more vulnerable because of that. The elder people sweat somewhat less, there's also a somewhat depressed thirst drive in people who are elderly, and so those things place the elderly at greater risk. And so when you have this adding up of risk factors, they amount to, extremely high risk. So, yeah, all of that is of great concern. And as was pointed out before, people of color and poor people are more likely to be in those vulnerable, homeless, and poorly housed situations, or working in jobs that keep them outside during this time.
Right. And what would you add, Christina?
Yeah, I think that was a very eloquent answer. And I think that this intersection between homelessness and air pollution exposure is a great example of the many ways in which climate change acts as a threat multiplier. On first glance, you might not think there's a connection between homelessness and the climate crisis, or racism and the climate crisis. But when we dig into it, we can see that the systems that have made it difficult to solve the homelessness problem, for example, here in California, do intersect with the climate crisis. The climate change will make exposure to extreme heat and air pollution from wildfires among the homeless population greater. So it becomes much more imperative that we ramp up our systems for coping with homelessness and helping people to transition to safe housing and to, back into the workforce potentially where we can, so that that population isn't disproportionately exposed to the risks associated with climate change. So, the longer I work in the field of climate change research, the more I see these connections between things that, the average listener might not see those connections. But if we start to look deeper into almost any major societal problem, we can see the ways that it will be exacerbated by climate change, which should be impetus for working to solve some of those problems in tandem with the policies that we need to solve the climate crisis.
Dr. Sarfati, cities are trying to get the word out. If you subscribe to Nixl, every day I get a text that says the air quality is very unhealthy. Stay inside as much as possible. But I still see people out running. I see people out eating outdoors. I mean, people are just tired of being inside. What would you say? What effects, do even a couple of hours outside on a really bad day have on public health?
Well, that is a very good question. The exact length of time that you can be exposed and, how much damage that causes is something that people have worked on by trying to quantify it by the number of cigarettes smoked. So there is a website that will tell you, if the air quality index is between 100 and 200 and you're out for 24 hours, it's equivalent to smoking a certain number of cigarettes per day. And so that's one way that there have been efforts to help understand exactly, what this does. But I think it's important to realize that the long-term impact is one thing, but the immediate impact is another. And there is definitely immediate impact. So for people who are compromised by virtue of some of those conditions I mentioned before, there can be near-term, more immediate effects that drive people to the emergency room and to hospitalization. And so, there have been increased hospitalizations during other fire seasons that have been documented, have been written up in the medical literature. And so we know that, right now and over the past few days, as these fires have been burning and the air quality has been so poor, there have surely been people who have been driven to emergency rooms because of immediate difficulties they face. And some of those groups that are most likely to get into immediate difficulty are those people who have underlying asthma or chronic lung disease or heart disease or already have some, brain involvement from atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries, and also pregnant women who, are breathing this and could end up, having problems with their pregnancies. So the immediate effects are real, and if the level of exposure is great enough, if the particulates are high enough, people who don't have an underlying condition can also begin to experience enough respiratory distress that they may end up having to go to an emergency room. And of course, that would be true for people who may have a COVID infection who would otherwise not get into as much trouble with their COVID infection. The near-term immediate impact can affect a lot of people.
That is Dr. Mona Sarfati, Director of the Program on Climate and Health at George Mason University's Center for Climate Change Communication. Christina Dahl is Senior Climate Scientist for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And if you have any questions or comments about how all of this is affecting our health and what needs to be done to truly tackle this crisis, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Genevieve says, I'd love to hear about what tangible on the ground work the UFW is doing to support farm workers during this unprecedented crisis. Well, Genevieve, it looks like based on a poll, farm workers say that their employers are not providing them masks. And so the UFW has tweeted that they are trying to provide masks to farm workers. I mean, what else could be done, Christina, when you're dealing with a population that has to work to pay the bills and their employer is not even handing out masks? And we're talking about the state of California here. What else can be done to help farm workers?
Well, like many things, we need to have stronger policies to protect workers, whether they're indoors or outdoors. California is one of just a few states in the country that has any protections for outdoor workers when it comes to extreme heat, for example. For the rest of the nation, outdoor workers, when it comes to extreme heat, are covered by OSHA's general duty clause, which says that employers have a general duty to ensure that working conditions are safe. But there's no federal level heat protection standard. Similarly, there's no federal level wildfire protection standard. And so it's very difficult for things like the distribution of personal protective equipment for farm workers to be enforced really rigorously. And so it does seem to be falling in many cases to individual employers. There was an article in the San Francisco Chronicle a few weeks ago from an owner of a small farm in Northern California who for the first time had made the decision not to have his workers continue to work. And he made the incredibly important point that a food system is not resilient if it requires the workers who are planting and harvesting and delivering that food to be exposed to extremely unhealthy conditions. And so we as a nation need to look really hard at the ways that we are treating farm workers and other outdoor workers, because increasingly they will be exposed to these really detrimental conditions. So looking at policies that can be enacted both at the state level as well as at the federal level, that would really implement enforceable standards for working environment conditions would be a great step forward.
All right. Well, thank you for that email, Genevieve. Let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. This is very troubling. It's hard to be civil because it seems to me that the major factor that continues to be avoided is inequality. The bottom line is, follow the money. Nobody's willing to pay for any of this. So you can talk with all of your callers about regulations, as the last caller talked about what we should do, but nobody's willing to pay for it. We're talking about mothers and infant care. This will affect children and the number of children in poverty. I'm very pleased, and I truly do not mean this critically of the doctor talking about her son or daughter, whomever, moved down the peninsula and has an air purifier. I have one, but most people can't afford one nowadays, and there's nothing being done about this. I'll leave it at that, except that I just wish this discussion could be had, all of these discussions, talking about the unwillingness of people to pay for this business and to actually do something about it.
Yeah, good point. Robert, thank you. I was just looking at air purifiers last night, and they average about $200, $250. What about this, Dr. Sarfati? I mean, when it comes to dealing with fires and the management of fires, we know that that costs a lot of money. And Robert makes a good point. This costs money. It's not just telling people to stay inside. A lot of people can't, but they need tools to now deal with this because it's gotten so bad. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I agree with that entirely. And, you know, for those who are spending time outside, N95 or even N99 masks should be widely available at very affordable costs. You know, that became an issue being able to be protected from COVID-19, and we saw that even the people working in hospitals were not getting the N95 masks that they needed when they're being directly exposed to COVID-19. So we should have, you know, a tremendous protection of production of N95 masks, you know, with free distribution, with distribution to the entire population, so that if people are outside, you know, there is that kind of personal protective equipment. And then with regard to indoor air, you know, with the proper government policies and willingness to pay for them, we could be widely distributing indoor air purifiers as well. And so, you know, it really is a matter of getting enough people and policymakers to understand how urgent this is, so that we can, you know, we can move the wheels of government and move government dollars to these needs. They're essential.
And Christina, it's a good point. I mean, this is so much more about, you know, you need to buy a filter for your family to keep you safe. Okay, fine. But there's so much more here. People cannot take this on at the individual or even family level.
Absolutely. And, you know, it costs money to address these problems right now. But the truth for most of these problems is that it costs much more to do nothing. Because in the long run, the problems build up and they become much more severe and they're much harder to deal with. And we have precedent for programs that have addressed very individual or household level needs. For example, in New York City, this past spring, they developed a program knowing that COVID-19 was going to need to keep people inside, knowing that we were expecting one of the hottest summers on record. And they developed a program for distributing tens of thousands of room air conditioner units to people who needed them. So we can put our minds to these things. We could do the same for air purifiers out here in California. And yes, it would cost money, but we would also potentially avoid the cost down the road of having to treat people in hospitals and having to, you know, the potential job losses they might face associated with that. So, you know, it's important to think not just about the immediate costs, but also the costs of inaction.
Exactly. Or also the costs of politicians who are actively working to make this worse by, you know, giving out new leases to drill, for example. But, you know, that we're almost out of time. That's actually for another show, but it is obviously so connected. Dr. Sarfati, when you look at reports on what's to possibly come if serious action is not taken. By the year 2050, hundreds of U.S. cities could see an entire month every year with heat index temperatures above 100 degrees if nothing is done. And this affects communities of color even more.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we are, I direct an organization called the Medical Society Consortium on Climate and Health, and there are 29 medical societies that have come together, you know, to inform the public and policymakers that, that we have to act now on climate, that it's a crisis, it's a health crisis, it's a health emergency. And we have 55 public health organizations, and some nursing organizations, organizations representing other health professions, and hospitals that are in agreement with us that we've got a health emergency. And we all support a policy agenda, which you can find at climatehealthaction.org, which lists, 10 things that need to be done to address the climate crisis. And the amazing thing is that most of them actually are beneficial to health. So not only would they help us slow down the climate crisis and end the degradation of our atmosphere, they would also directly benefit health. And so we need those kinds of policy changes. You know, we're trying to let the public and policymakers know that it's not a huge list, but it is a list of vital actions that we need to take to address climate change, stop the degradation of our atmosphere, and protect people from the adverse health effects.
Well, we would love to have you and some of your colleagues back to talk about what is on that list and what tangible changes are needed. Dr. Mona Sarfati is director of the Program on Climate and Health at George Mason University's Center for Climate Change Communication. Dr. Sarfati, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Christina Dahl is a senior climate scientist for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Christina, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. And you can find more information about this issue at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.